Thank you so much for that nice introduction. I am so pleased tonight to have the honor of introducing our featured speaker, Cynthia Rosenzweig. I learned of her work and the work with the Climate Research Group about 2 years ago when I was involved in the New York 2050 project, which was a citywide project in thinking of involving as many citizens of New York City to think about the future of New York and imagine the kind of New York that we would want to see in 50 or 100 years. Cynthia gave a presentation about related to the impacts of climate change in New York City. And I was so moved by her presentation that I tried to talk to her afterwards and I said, and I approached her about doing a sound project, which, you know, many of you are sound artists and know that this you approach people and they just say, okay, you're crazy, move on. But amazingly, much to my amazement, Cynthia was really interested in working on a sonification project that will play a little bit of the results of that project tonight. But let me just read a little bit about Cynthia's background so you get a sense of the important work that she and her research group have been doing. Dr. Cynthia Rosenzweig is a senior research scientist at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies at Columbia University. Her primary research involves the development of interdisciplinary methodologies by which to assess the potential impacts of and adaptations to global environmental change. Dr. Rosenzweig has organized and led large-scale interdisciplinary national and international studies of climate change impacts and adaptation. She is the co-leader of the Metropolitan East Coast Regional Assessment of the U.S. National Assessment of the Potential Consequences of Climate Variability and Change, which was sponsored by the U.S. Global Change Research Program. She leads the Climate Impacts Research Group at the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, whose mission is to investigate the interactions of climate on systems and sectors important to human well-being. And I'm just so pleased to welcome Cynthia here to the welcoming ceremony for the Ear to the Earth, and please join me in...
Thank you, Andrea, and also thank you, Joel. It's really very exciting for me to be here interacting with all of you. When we started working with Andrea, I realized that science, certainly the science that I do and many of my colleagues do, is primarily visual. We work very hard at creating visual images of our data to explain to people. So working with Andrea was so amazing because it opened up the potential for a whole new sense, a whole new way of communicating our data through sound. So we really, from our side, also found it tremendously exciting. I think that the interaction is also indicative of something of the nature of the global climate change issue, which is so enormous in the way that it is based on our civilization's use of energy, that in order to solve this, we have to work together across all boundaries, across visual boundaries, sound boundaries, across disciplinary boundaries. We work with economists, sometimes that's really quite difficult, with biologists, with climate scientists, and in that regard, actually, I want to introduce two colleagues who came with me, who are visiting our NASA GIS research lab. David Caroli is here, an Australian climate scientist, and Gino Casassa is here from Chile. He's a cryosphere specialist, a glaciologist. So I said to them, any hard questions that you guys ask, they have to answer. But You can see that I'm an impact scientist working in particular. What I'm going to share today is our work in urban areas. David is a meteorologist and climate dynamics scientist. Gino spends sometimes when I would be speaking with him, Gino would say, "I'm calling from the South Pole." So this concept of crossing boundaries, I think, is part of the nature of this enormous global environmental challenge of climate change. One other general remark before I turn to showing a little bit about the global science, the science of the global climate change, and then how it might relate to us and our wonderful New York metropolitan region, is that I think that we are also now, in regard to the issue, in a new phase. And I think everyone would agree. For about 20 years, two decades, the scientists were pretty much in their research institutes doing a lot of climate model simulations and trying to get the word out. But that it has been really, it has really taken about 20 years, two decades really, some of those first climate model simulations with doubled carbon dioxide in the atmosphere were done up at Goddard Institute for Space Studies and other places as well. But they were done here, right here in New York City, some of the first ones, in the early 80s. It's taken all this time for, I think, the issue to seep into consciousness of in a much wider way through the society. And I now think that we truly are in a new phase of awareness of the issue. I think that's happened for a lot of reasons. One is the steady drumbeat of observations, a lot of them from the melting glaciers and what's happening with the ice caps and the ice sheets. Another is Hurricane Katrina. Even though we can't say for sure that Hurricane Katrina is caused completely by global warming, it certainly was a tremendous object lesson about the power of nature to affect our world. It was also an object lesson about the response of government to large-scale natural disasters. And I think maybe previously with global warming, people would think, well, it's very far in the future, and we won't worry about it because the government is going to take care of us. I think that after Katrina and the response to Katrina, it's much harder for all of us to have that feeling about the global warming and global climate change issue. Another reason why I think we're in a different phase right now is that it has come forward about repression of science by the administration. And I think, again, we felt, well, you know, science was going to be, was getting out, there was a level playing field, but it really has turned out that in this country there really has not been a level playing field about the dissemination of the science. But the final reason why I think we're in the new phase is, of course, the media. And probably the best known example, of course, is the movie by Al Gore. But it's so much more than that. It's all of the print and documentaries that are on TV weekly now. It's been actually quite very amazing for us to be part of those kinds of media, producing some of those kind of media as well. But the role of the media now is, as you all know, of course, is so important. So this new phase that we're in is very much because of the embracing of the issue by the media, and that's why it's so wonderful to share. And I want to not talk too long. Scientists can go on and talk for hours and hours, but I don't want to talk for too long because then I really want to get to the media part of the evening, so that Andrea can play the sonification of our global climate model results of global warming in New York City. So what I'm going to do very quickly on this dark screen is just share a little bit of some of the visual representations of climate change. So let's go to the next one, which shows that one of the very challenging parts about the global climate change issue is the uncertainties. We don't know exactly what the climate will be like in the 2050s or the 2080s or the century after that. But part of the reason why it's taken 25 years to actually come to this new phase is those uncertainties. But what this slide is showing is, what this graphic is showing is, what the main certainties about the issue are. So the top part is our understanding of our planet's natural greenhouse effect, in which our atmospheric blanket of greenhouse gases, which absorbs long-wave radiation, keeps heat and warmth around our planet. This is very well understood and has been understood for decades and even centuries, because it was over about 100 years ago that Arrhenius, a Swedish scientist, realized that if with the Industrial Revolution the burning of fossil fuel would put more carbon dioxide, one of the main greenhouse gases which holds in the heat. And he made a back-of-the-envelope calculation, which is not all that different from what all our fancy models today are saying. So the first one is our understanding of the way our planetary energy balance works. The second certainty is on the left here. It's the carbon dioxide concentration since about 1860. This actually has been going up in a more rapid way since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution at the end of the 1700s. But basically, what you can see is from ice cores and then on top of Mauna Loa, where it's now measured from the atmosphere, that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases have been increasing for the approximately 200 years in an intense form. And the next one is that our global average temperature over the same period, this is from 1860, has been rising as well. These are all based on data and physical understanding. None of this is a model. These are the heart of the issue, that our human burning of fossil fuels and clearing of forests for agriculture is putting more gases in our atmosphere that absorb long-wave radiation that serve to warm our Earth now, but with more of them, we're going to have more warming. It's going to get hotter. So that was one line showing the warmer temperatures. That was the global average temperature on the right. This shows where those temperatures have been occurring, those warming temperatures across the world. So this is for the past 30 years. And actually, David, these are the temperature data. This is the project that Gino and David and I are working on this week. This shows over the past 30 years where the warming has occurred. And what you can see is, basically, everywhere where there's yellow, even the light green, only the blue parts are places where it's getting cooler. It is getting warmer over most places in the Earth, and it has been especially for the last 30 years. Everywhere you see a dot, there has been an effect of that warming. See, as an impact scientist, I say to my climate science friends, well, what does it mean that it's 1.5 degrees warmer in centigrade? What does it mean to anybody or anything? So what we're doing in this project is we're documenting where the birds are laying eggs earlier, where the spring is coming earlier in the crops, when the farmers are responding, and where the glaciers are melting, where the snow extent is retreating. That's what those dots are. So we see that we are in a warming world already. The next one, please. But you can ask the question, well, you just showed data for about 150 years, and you said, okay, it's been warming since then, but what if maybe 300 years ago there was similar amount of warming. So what our climate science colleagues spend a lot of time doing is looking to the past to compare and see, well, what, you know, is this unusual or not? So what this shows is the global temperature, the anomalies, that means the changes from the mean over about the past 2,000 years. Actually, there's going to be a new version of this. This is a very famous plot called the hockey stick because of the shape. And we have the present up at the right, where we have the temperatures shooting up as we were looking at, and so there's a lot of controversy about how that line is drawn, and the yellow is showing the uncertainties. There's a lot of uncertainties as we look to the past, but what we do see is that it appears as if our warming that we are experiencing is indeed unusual, on the order of about the 2,000 years. But, you know, the Earth's history is a lot longer than this. So the next one shows the temperatures over approximately 400,000 years. And also on this graph is not showing not only the temperatures, but the carbon dioxide concentration and methane concentration as well, which is another greenhouse gas. So what you can see here are the glacial periods when it's very cold, and then the rapid warming to the interglacial periods, and these cycles that we've experienced over 400,000 years. And the levels of CO2 as those glacial and interglacial periods were occurring was on the order of 200 to 300 parts per million. That's the concentration of that greenhouse gas keeping us warm. Up on the right again, we have our present situation of our carbon dioxide, which shows that we're now at 380 parts per million, and just about 380. And so this is one of the reasons why the scientists have brought forward the issue, because on this perspective from very long time frames, we are having, it is indeed unusual warming and unusual amounts of the greenhouse gases. Next one. Now, this one is, I think, a very important question, which is, how do we know that the humans, I've been showing you these lines that appear to be correlated, but how do we actually know that the temperatures are being affected by the gases? In order to test that, scientists and our colleagues use global climate models to do a kind of, it's almost like a thought experiment with the models, which are, the models are mathematical representations of all of the climate system all around the globe. And the way that they do it is that they test the models first on the upper left with just the things in our climate system that affect the temperature. Those are called climate forcings just by themselves, just the natural ones. So some of those are, for example, volcanoes going off. When a volcano goes off, it shoots sulfate aerosols high into the atmosphere, and that has a cooling effect. And then there are differences in, for example, solar variability. So everything natural that can affect the global temperatures are tested first in the model. And then they're compared to observations. So the red line is the observations. That's us getting warmer. But if we only use the natural forcings, that's the black line. The one on the right is taking just the anthropogenic forcings. That's all these greenhouse gases that I showed you previously. There's carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, and other ones as well. So the one on the right is showing that you do a better job when you add in what humans have been doing to the system. But you get the very best one of all in terms of relating our understanding through the model of what's happened to our temperatures over the past 150 years when you combine the natural forcings and the anthropogenic forcings. And this is really the argument on which the global warming issue rests, coming from the climate scientists. Now let's leave the past and the present and now head into the future. So using those same models, we put, the climate scientists put into the model projections of how our burning of fossil fuels would increase in the future. And that depends on, there's not just one trajectory, it's very uncertain. Here comes a lot of the uncertainties. How many people we're going to have on the Earth, what kind of economic growth we're going to have, and what kind of technologies are we going to have. So on the right, you see that there's a range from the lowest emissions of the greenhouse gases to the highest. And this is now going from 2000 to 2100, and these are the projections of the global mean temperature over time. And again, we're not just showing one line, there's a range because it's trying to capture some of those uncertainties. But what we see is on the order of 2 to 4 degrees centigrade, you know, roughly double that for Fahrenheit, and we see that there is projected to have an inexorable rise of temperature in the Earth if we continue in emitting greenhouse gases in basically the way that we are doing it. Now, several important things have come out lately about the climate that that scientists are tracking very carefully. Because when I showed you before that those projections of the temperatures to 2100, it looked very smooth, right? But really, there's the potential for surprises. And because of discontinuities in the system, there may be real jumps and changes and surprises in what we see in the climate. So the first one on the left has to do with Gino's specialty, and Gino has been co-author on some of the papers talking about the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which appears to be happening in a more rapid way than had been previously thought. That's the one on the left. The one on the right is known as the ocean circulation conveyor belt. This is a massive river in the ocean which transports heat around the planet. And because of the melting of the land glaciers and increase in runoff, the pump of that conveyor belt may be losing power because of increase in fresh water into the oceans, so that there is a potential for a modification of the heat distribution around the planet. And this is the quote scenario which was depicted in the movie Day After Tomorrow. Now, the thing about the Day After Tomorrow is that the movie makers only had us in the audience for about 2 hours. So everything had to happen very fast. There's no way that this could happen as rapidly as it showed, and it was portrayed in the movie. I think it was like over a week or something. This would be, first of all, modification, not just an abrupt shutdown. And this would happen, both of these melting, the melting and these kinds of changes in the heat distribution in the ocean would happen over on centuries time scale. So those are two of the things that have very much been in the news lately. And then the final one, of course, is hurricanes. What the data are showing is that there has been, this is on the left, an increase in the intensity of hurricanes in both in what we call tropical cyclones in both the Atlantic and the Pacific. Not in the frequency, but in the intensity. And that primarily has to do with because I've been showing you warming of the Earth. Well, the oceans are warming up too. That map showed that the oceans are warming. Warmer sea surface temperatures is one of the main forces that affects the intensity of hurricanes. So this is data showing that there is an increase in intensity. And when we project to the future, it is very likely that the warmer sea surface temperatures would be affecting the intensity of the hurricanes as well. It's hard to say about the frequency because many things affect that, including El Niño. For our hurricanes here on the Atlantic and on the East Coast, it depends on what happens to El Niño in the Pacific. So the system is very complicated. So let's go on. Now what I want to do is ask the question, all these global maps and graphs that I'm showing you, what does it mean for right here in New York? So we were very fortunate a few years ago to be able to work with a whole team of researchers from universities around town, but not only the researchers, but stakeholders as well, decision makers who run, for example, our transportation system and our health systems, our energy, et cetera. And so we got together a team of people, not just scientists, but what we call decision makers, stakeholders, to ask this question: what does this mean for New York? And so these are the climate model projections at the global scale, but then we downscaled them to the region. And by the way, I have brought a copy of the report, and if anybody wants a copy, just let me know or send me an email, and we'll send you the CD and also show you the website where it's on. So the first question we ask is, I showed you those global warming graphs. Has New York been warming over the last 100 years? And the answer in the top graph is yes. And actually, it's been warming at a greater rate than the global rate, and the global average. And this is with our urban heat island removed. Our city is warmer in any case, but that because of our buildings, which absorb radiation. But this is with that effect removed. But we have been warming basically steadily. And for people who grew up here long ago, like me, there was much more snow when we were kids. There was a lot more snow and many more snow days. So in some ways, it was better to be a kid before. We also looked to see have there been any changes in our rainfall. We see an increase, actually, which is what we would expect with a warmer world. And what you actually see, though, which is very interesting, is that, see, the dots are going higher and lower. Actually, this would be interesting to work with Andrea too, because we're finding that we're having more extremes of precipitation, greater amounts and also lesser amounts, which is also more droughts and more floods is what is projected to accompany global warming. So how do you relate global warming here? So you say, well, what are our climate stresses? How do we experience climate? And so one of the things we talked about already is the hurricanes, but we have another big kind of storm here called nor'easters, which have brought some tremendous storms and damages. So we look at the extremes and the storms. We look at heat waves, of course. That's a big stress on many of our elderly and our young people. And then droughts and floods. So these are the kinds of things. And here we're looking not at mean climate, because, again, I don't think we relate very well to mean climate. It's the extremes that are actually going to affect us and how they change. So then we look and see, and with colleagues, look at a whole variety of studies to see how things might be affected by this. So I've put together a few this is first just in the Northeast region, then we'll go down to New York. So recreation will shift. Beaches will be very important, but at the same time, sea level rise may erode those beaches more. So we may have to pay more money to put more sand on our beaches. That's how we maintain our beaches now. The Army Corps of Engineers does that. But ski areas will very likely be shrinking, and we'll have a harder time creating snow. There are a lot of interactions with human health. First, the direct heat stress, but also diseases like Lyme disease and the ticks that carry it. Because all biological creatures have a relationship with climate, with an optimal temperature where they're doing well. And if we move into a warmer closer to the optimum of some of the disease vectors, then our human health can definitely be affected. And then we just put in some of our special iconic species, like lobster, for example, is very attuned to the water temperature. So we'll still perhaps be able to get lobster, but we'd have to go up to Canada as opposed to going up to Maine in the summer. So these are some of the shifts that everything basically will be reacting. Let's go to the next one. This is something, I just mentioned the health, and this is another aspect of the health which is very serious and very important here in terms of the change with a warming climate. This is work that we've done with people at the Columbia School of Public Health, And the on the left are the temperature changes, and on the right are the ozone changes. Because the air pollution that we experience now is affected by the more hot days we have, the more ozone we have, and the more air pollution problems. And then there is a relation with asthma, for example, and asthma-related hospital visits. So there are some very serious negative effects associated that are projected to occur in the coming decades. Very briefly, I talked about that the climate change integrates across sectors and systems. It's no longer just one thing separated from another. So the next three slides, I think, are demonstrating that. We have to think about the effects of sea level rise and storm surges on our infrastructure. That's our three airports are on drained coastal wetlands, basically at sea level, so our airports are definitely threatened. This is the Holland Tunnel entrance with the level of a hurricane category 3 here. These are Port Authority transportation infrastructures. But at the same time, New York is not only, and this is part of the meaning of your festival, New York is not only the built environment, it's the ecosystem. That's our Jamaica Bay. We have a recreation area, a famous bird stop over there, and we worked with them and found that the wetlands have already been with accelerated loss. We are suggesting in part due to sea level rise associated with climate change. Not completely. Very, very complex situation. But we have to think about our ecosystems in our region as well, not just the built environment. The next one is energy, of course, and health. I mentioned the asthma on the right are asthma data related to socioeconomic data. But, you know, with our blackouts that we have and in lower socioeconomic neighborhoods and our increasing use of air conditioning, that's what the bottom panel is all about, there's going to be real strain on our systems in our energy use. And I think the next one shows that too. On the bottom is that there's an increase in the peak load. That's what causes the blackouts. It's when our peak loads are threatened. So, and we, because I work for NASA, I always show a satellite picture. So that's the one that's showing the temperature and the vegetation combined. This is very, very new work, we felt from the beginning was important to do, and we've just really been very fortunate to be able to bring it forward, which has to do with the socioeconomic vulnerability in the city to climate change. We are not all equally vulnerable, and it's very important to realize that so we created a vulnerability index and working with some of the environmental justice groups here to really see what the differential vulnerability to climate change is throughout the city. Let's turn now at the end to solutions. Because part of this new phase is not just the awareness of global warming, it's that basically we're ready, I believe, to roll up our sleeves and say, okay, we get it. And this is, by the way, what all of when we worked with the New Yorkers on this study, basically they would say, okay, we get it. What are we going to do about it? And basically there are two main responses to global warming. The first one we call mitigation, and that has to do with reducing the atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases. That's the root cause. So the main process by which those are increased are by the burning of fossil fuels. So there's lots of things that can be done to become more efficient, back down from coal to oil to natural gas, just steadily increase the percentage of renewable fuels in our fuel mix and just get going in backing down from the fossil fuel use. Then we have, that's on the electrical generation side, then there's the transportation issues. We do have one of the strongest public transportation systems in the world. That's great. We have to make it better. We have to make people we want to take the subway all the time, and we don't want to drive our car into the city, et cetera, things like that. So there's lots on those. But the second part of the response is, what this graph is showing, where that arrow is that even if we stopped right now and were able to stabilize our atmospheric concentrations, because of the amount of greenhouse gases that we've put into the atmosphere already, it's going to warm up some. What we're trying to do is limit the eventual magnitude of that and the rate. So we are going to have to adapt to a changing climate. So those are the two responses and the two solutions, two solution sets, I would say. One of the things that we've become very interested in is actually ecological infrastructure that does both, that works on both of those, both mitigation and adaptation. So we've been working with architects at the Graduate School of Architecture and at Columbia, and also at the New School, Joe Towers and others, and to see about the potential for having green roofs or living or vegetated roofs, which are beginning to pop up around town now. And what's very exciting about this solution is it works on mitigation, because people are cooler, they don't need to turn on their air conditioning as much if you have a garden or a grass or succulents on top of your roof. So it reduces greenhouse fossil fuel use through reducing air conditioning. But at the same time, people are cooler, so it's an adaptation. So as it gets warmer, having green roofs, living in a building with a green roof would also make us cooler. And the real reason, those two things and having them interact, I think is very important, because it also gives a potential, and I think these are the kinds of solutions that I think we really need to work together on, is solutions that are transformative. We want to transform our city to make it even better and more wonderful, so that it's not just, well, we're continuing our consumer lifestyle and where everything is business as usual. Let's work together to actually transform our environment. And I think that's really in part of what you're doing this week in the festival. It's because your artists work at that transformative level. So I really, really mean it and appreciate it that Andrea came and encouraged me to work with her. So this is the last one, just moving towards solutions. You know, I refuse to be pessimistic about climate change. I think it's tremendously challenging, but I think that at the same time, it's a tremendous opportunity for transformation, and that's how we should address it, roll up our sleeves and say, we are going to transform our civilization. So the climate system is changing, and we're going to hear that through Andrea. And let's now listen to. Was that it? What was that? So let's listen to what the future will be in New York City. Thank you.
Excerpt. This is also on the installation in the back corner, so you can listen to them in the sonifications in their entirety, and also listen to some interviews with Cynthia talking about some of the issues related to climate change that you heard here. Now, let me just say something about the model that was used in terms of creating these sonifications. When you're working with climate data, what I've found is that you, when you're creating sonifications from climate data, what I've found is that you get a very kind of ambient sound, because climate has a really repetitive kind of movement in the as the seasons move along. So the way I constructed these had to do with thinking about what kind of sound would be alarming. You know, it was an interesting exercise, because it was trying to create a kind of an emotional reaction in listeners and help people to realize the alarming changes that would be happening. So I used the model of kind of noise on the radio, and I was thinking about when you're tuning your radio and your radio goes out of tune and you hear this kind of static. So as there's an increased level of warming, you'll hear some more kind of static. So let me just play for you actual temperatures in the summer in the center of Central Park in the 1990s. This was measured data. I'll just play a short excerpt. Moving to the changes in a model in the 2020s. One thing we also worked with in working with Cynthia, she was talking about, she would tell me about how when a temperature reached a very hot level, the level of the 90 degrees Fahrenheit, they were finding more people going to emergency rooms and higher levels of energy consumption. So I used 90 degrees as kind of a marker for more intense sound. So you'll hear some of that here in the 2020s. And I should say, and I think this is correct, Cynthia, that this was the most conservative model that we used. And these are the projections of climate change in New York City in the 2050s. And then finally, I'll end with the 2080s, which you can see. By the middle to end of the 2080s, we're going to be seeing just an intense buildup of days over 90 degrees, over 100 degrees, and some very that. And if you want to listen to more, feel free to check out the installation, which will be up for the duration of the festival. And thanks. Let me now move to the second part of the evening, This evening tonight has been co-sponsored by the New York Society for Acoustic Ecology, and I'd like to introduce Michelle Nagai.